Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call, a show created at KALW with the support of listeners like you. As you listen to the programming you value, give your support to KALW's September campaign. Join us for the first time or renew your membership at KALW.org. Thank you. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. A couple of years ago, today's guest, best-selling author Peggy Ornstein, realized that her daughter wouldn't be a little girl for much longer. When she was in preschool, her daughter, Peggy Ornstein did extensive research about the Princess Industrial Complex and was convinced that its innocent pink and pretty culture was priming little girls for something more insidious later on. For Peggy, that later on is now. So she began thinking about sex. Do today's young women have more freedom than their moms to shape their sexual encounters? Do they have more influence and more control? Well, Peggy began to interview high school and college age girls about sex, internet porn, hookup culture, sexual assault, objectification, and many other issues. And she writes about her findings in her book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She writes, quote, "They talked about towing that line between virgin and slut. They told me about boys who were aggressive and boys who were caring, boys who abused them and boys who restored their faith in love. Fully half the girls had experienced something along a spectrum of coercion to rape." End quote. Many of her findings are very disturbing, but this is a conversation we need to have. Peggy Ornstein is the author of many books, including the best-selling Girls and Sex, Cinderella Ate My Daughter, and the classic Schoolgirls, Young Women, Self-Esteem, and the Confidence Gap. She's a contributing writer to a number of publications, including the New York Times. And Peggy Ornstein joins me in studio. Hi, Peggy. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I still think about how disturbing your book was the first time I read it, but it's full of such great information. You were on a couple months ago when it came out, and we wanted to have you back. And I understand since then you have been inundated with requests from high schools and colleges to come speak about this issue.
Yeah, it's been very intense. I'm worried that my family's going to forget my name. It's been it's been a lot, but it's been tremendous. And it's, what's been really fun, especially in high schools, is that I always ask that a girl introduce me rather than an adult. And it always ends up being basically the same intro where the girl will start out by saying, "My teacher made me read this book. And at first, I really didn't want to because I thought, what does this old lady know about my world and my life? And then I started reading it." And it really speaks to them, and they end up being the biggest advocates. So I love having that, continuing to have that ongoing relationship with young women and hearing what their lives are about, as well as talking about what I found to them.
And you write that most of the 70 girls that you interviewed said people have never asked questions about these issues.
Never.
Ever. Is that what you're also finding when you're speaking with young girls?
Yeah, you know, we really just don't have this conversation about, we don't have honest, frank conversations about sexuality with girls or boys. And I should say that now I'm transitioning and I'm working on a companion book that's about boys. With the girls, though, and I had a really interesting conversation the other day with somebody at Indiana University at the Kinsey Institute who was saying, it's like we have this fear of having this conversation about sex with kids. So we create almost like a filter where the good stuff doesn't get through, the good conversation, and instead all the garbage of the culture, all the exploitative stuff, all of the distorted stuff, all the pornographic stuff gets through really well. But we don't let anything real get through to them.
So how did you deal with that in the conversations that you had?
With the girls I was interviewing?
The good and the bad. And what you chose to focus on.
I just asked questions. And young women were really eager to have the discussion about, one of the big things that I wanted to find out about from the get-go, and you have to remember that I started doing this book really before the Dear Colleague letter that sparked the latest round of the anti-assault movement on campuses. So that wasn't really on my radar, and I was really interested in whether girls were able to advocate for their own sexual pleasure and what was going on with that in their relationship. So what I was finding was that girls were never asked about that. And today's young women felt entitled to engage in sexual behavior in a way that maybe earlier generations did not, but they didn't necessarily feel entitled to enjoy it. Mm. And that was one of the big differences.
That's one of the things that struck me. You found that the concern with pleasing someone, yeah, as opposed to pleasure was pervasive, even among smart, confident girls.
Right. And that was, I purposely was talking to girls who were in college or college bound because I wanted to talk to young women who we thought of as having opportunity and who we point to as being the beneficiaries of feminism, because I thought if even those girls who were, you know, so ambitious and educated and, you know, leaning in all over the place and all that, if even they were toppling in their personal lives, then it would be hard to deny that there was a problem. So, for instance, one of the young women that I talked to said to me, you know, I come from this long line of smart, strong women, and my grandma was a firecracker, my mother's a professional, my sister and I are loud and proud, and that's our form of feminine power. And then she proceeded to tell me about her sex life, which had been a series of one-offs that were, you know, not very respectful, not very responsible, not particularly reciprocal, not particularly enjoyable. And she said, I don't know. You know, I think we girls are just socialized to be meek and deferential and not express our wants and needs. And I said, yeah, you know, 5 minutes ago you told me how smart and strong you were. And she kind of hemmed and hawed and said, yeah, but nobody ever told me that that smart, strong image applied to sex. Mm.
Do you think it's because we now talk about equal pay and when you negotiate, you know, ask for more money, strive, you know, like you said, the mm-hmm. lean in thing. But on this issue, we don't.
Silent. You know what's really weird to me? I feel like my generation, certainly, and I'm kind of old for the age that my daughter is. I see this all the time when I speak, that there's sort of a point, age point, over which women will barrel up to me and say, what happened to our bodies ourselves? Right? Because my generation, we were like, you know, all getting together with our speculums and a flashlight and, you know, all that. Lefty women like me. and I don't fully know the answer to that. I keep going back to this, like, what happened to the women? Why did we not pass that along to our daughters? Was it because AIDS made sex equal death? Was it because of right-wing pressures and abstinence only? Was it because of Clinton saying that oral sex was not sex? And that's a whole issue that we need to discuss, mm-hmm. that oral sex is not sex. I don't have an answer to that, but it seems to me that somehow we dropped the ball in moving forward on talking more holistically to our children about how to have sexual encounters once we stopped saying don't.
The girls that you interviewed who expressed so much more concern with pleasing mm-hmm. instead of pleasure, have you talked to them since having these conversations and writing this book, and have their views about this changed?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Rose. There's some of them that I have stayed in pretty close touch with, and they have become friends, really. And it's one of the real gifts of this book for me as a human being, I guess, is that I've developed all these relationships with young women across this generational line, which is sort of what I advocate, that if you can't talk to your child, mm-hmm. you need to find somebody who can. And if you can, you know, and being able to be that person for all these young women once the book was over and I no longer had to be the reporter anymore and have that journalistic distance has been, I think, a great relationship for both them and for me, not for all 70 of them, obviously, but for a handful of them and for new ones who come along. I get emails just about every day from young women who say, I've described their lives, I've described their situation, they want to talk about it. And I don't know, it's been, I've even gotten them from, and I won't name names, but from some celebrity from like Hollywood young women who read the book and wanted to talk about what it's like to feel that they have to self-objectify in front of the camera and all of this. And wow. It's been a pretty interesting experience.
Wow.
Yeah.
And talk a little bit about, let's talk about the positives before we talk about some of the more disturbing things. But when you talk about pleasure, mm-hmm. what changes would you like to see? I mean, for people who don't know, what is currently taught in school about sex?
Oh, gosh, that so depends on where you live. Mm. I mean, it might be abstinence only. It is probably a risk and danger model. If it is a progressive model, it tends to be more about prevention and, you know, what you shouldn't do. And, you know, one of the things that I point to in the book as a model is the way that things are done in Holland. It's always someplace like Holland, you know. But there was this the one piece of research was they looked at 800 college women, half in America and half in Holland. And they looked at this was, again, white. They used sort of apples to apples. So it was sort of white Protestant middle class college girls. So they matched with the Dutch girls talking about their early sexual experiences. And the Dutch had everything. The Dutch girls had everything that we say we want. Right, they had fewer negative consequences like pregnancy, disease, being drunk when they had, you know, so drunk they didn't know what they were doing, and more positive consequences like knowing their partner very well, being able to communicate their wants and needs and limits, using contraception if they were having intercourse, enjoying the experience, better body image, all these things. And the big difference was that they said that their parents, teachers, and doctors had been talking to them openly and clearly about sex from a very early age, and in particular the parents, the American parents weren't necessarily less comfortable talking about sex, but they framed it exclusively in terms of risk and danger. Mm. And the Dutch parents talked about balancing joy and responsibility. And as a parent myself, that really struck me because I know that had I not delved into that research, I would have talked to my own daughter about contraception, about disease protection, and because I'm very modern, I would have had a big conversation about consent. And I would have thought I'd done a really good job. And now I know that that's really not enough.
And so where does that come from? How did they get to that place to focus on joy and responsibility?
Well, it's interesting. They had... When the sexual revolution of the, you know, 60s, 70s happened, they were very similar to Americans. They had had a, you know, no sex till marriage model. And they made a decision as those changes came into the culture to embrace them and to try to support young people and educate young people to have positive ethical attitudes about sexuality. And we kind of did the opposite. And the other piece is that they, you know, we tend to look at the teenage years. Well, you know, we kind of force our children to lie to us in a lot of ways, right? We force a rift. We see teenagers as rebellious. We see them, and we force girls in particular into being one person at home and another person out in the world, particularly if they're sexually active. And the Dutch talk about this thing, I cannot say this word, but it's like something like that, which is cozy togetherness. And in that model, all of these issues are expected to be embedded in the family structure, and kids are expected to remain close to their parents. And that, too, I read and I thought, I don't want to create a rift with my daughter in the teenagers. I mean, as much as I can avoid it, I want her to feel that she can come to me and talk to me and that it's a time for our relationship, yes, to grow and change. And I'm not, you know, I have a 13-year-old, so it's not like I think it's easy, but to also remain close and have those conversations. And we do. We have really great conversations, she and I, right now.
Can you talk a little bit about that for parents who might not know how to broach this subject?
You know, for me, what has been the big cheat, and I think that parents can, you know, can use this moment right now that we're discussing for this, is that I wrote a book, Rose. So my daughter has ended up hearing me speak, and she's been kind of, you know, she's had to follow me around sometimes when I do radio interviews, and that has opened doors and sparked conversation for us. And I think what I've heard a lot of, and I really support this, is parents listening to podcasts of interviews that I've done with their children. Mm. I hear this a lot. And that, for one thing, you can do it in the car when you're not looking at each other, but that has sparked a lot of conversation because I think it's a really great inroad to be able to say, you know, she's saying this and such about these kids, what's happening in your world, instead of, you know, like boring right in on your kid's experience right away when you've never done that before.
Today, I'm joined by journalist Peggy Ornstein. We're talking about her new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She interviewed 70 girls in high school and college about sex and porn and hookup culture, self-objectification, and many other issues. And if you have any questions or comments for Peggy, we'd love to hear from you. How do you talk to young people about these issues? And we'd love to hear about, if you have a child in school, what they learn about sex. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And then when it comes to joy and pleasure, the other side of don't, and be careful, how are you managing to have that conversation with your children? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. So what changes would you like to see in the classroom? Because a lot of kids do not have these conversations with their parents. They learn all of it from, well, now I was going to say magazines. That's where I learned it, from Cosmo.
Right.
But a lot of kids are learning it online.
Yeah, through porn,
right,
really.
You know,
and that is really disturbing. There was a piece of research that I looked at that said that it was a survey of college students in the UK, a huge survey, and 60% of them said that they consult porn in part as sex education, to see how things work, to get ideas about what they like and don't like. And, you know, it's another realm where women are there for male pleasure. You know, that's what women's sexuality is presented as. And there's often humiliation and degradation of women. Bodies are distorted. Women are shown, you know, liking things that they don't necessarily like often. Men are just, you know, it's not where you want them to be getting those ideas. And I saw kids, they talked about those ideas sort of coming into the bedroom. So on the more G-rated end of the spectrum, a lot of girls would say to me, my boyfriend wants to know why I don't make the noises that women make in porn. And, you know, as a journalist, I'm supposed to have sort of a distance. That was one of those things that would just make that distance crumble. Right. And I would say, look, it's a movie. A movie has to have a soundtrack, or it's a silent movie. So if they didn't have any make any noises, you know, it would be weird, and that's why they make the noises. But, you know, so it's so it's not just porn. I've had conversations about porn with my daughter, but then once we had a conversation about porn, and shortly after that we were watching the movie Brooklyn. And that is, like, there's nothing wrong with the movie Brooklyn. Great movie. I enjoyed it very much. But it has a very typical sex scene in it where the characters, like, kiss for 3 seconds, rip off their clothes, jump into bed. Apparently they have intercourse for approximately, you know, 2.5 seconds. And then everybody's kind of happy. And that is as unrealistic. I mean, all of it. And porn is about as realistic as pro wrestling. That's what I always say to kids. But what I say to about that is, like, I said to my daughter, like, you know how when they show a taxi ride in a movie, they show the character getting into the cab, and then they show the character getting out of the cab, and they don't show the whole part in between? It's like that, right? This is not sex. This is like what movies use to symbolize that sex has occurred, but it really has about that much relationship to actual sexuality. And you need to understand that too, that these images that you're seeing, whether they're pornographic images or people want to now say sexually explicit internet images so that it's not as, you know, provocative, or whether you want to say that it's just your average, you know, PG-13 or R-rated movie, none of that is realistic. And kids really need to, you have to have that literacy. You have to have that conversation.
It's so important. Are some schools talking about porn in sex ed classes?
You know, I keep asking that question, and I have not personally found that, but that doesn't mean that that's not happening. I mean, I end the book in a sex education classroom, and it's one with locally, with a woman named Karis Dennison, who is a consultant and goes to schools around the Bay Area and around the country, and she's fantastic. And she always says that, you know, her job is to help her students make as many choices as they can that end in joy and honor rather than shame and guilt. And in her classroom, what's really terrific is that boys and girls are working these issues out together, and they're working them out in a really open-hearted way. So there was one point that I really loved where this boy raised his hand in some conversation, I can't remember what they were talking about, and he said, hey, you know that baseball metaphor that we always use for sex? I never thought about it before, but in baseball, there's winners and losers, So who's the loser supposed to be in sex? And I thought, you know, it was like one of those really tiny moments, but really paradigm shifting for him. And I feel like he will go into his encounters from there on thinking of girls more as partners than as adversaries whose challenges are, I mean, whose limits are challenges that he's supposed to get over.
Mm-hmm. When you were on the show last time, a few people called in and said there needs to be a book for boys,
yeah,
or, and about boys. And so you do touch on boys in your book.
I end on boys.
You end on boys. And so the next book, you're going to be interviewing boys about these issues?
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny because, you know, you write a book and you turn it in about a year before it comes out. And then there's the, you know, and I ended the book on a boy and on this idea that we can't just talk to girls, with no intention whatsoever of writing a second book. No intention. And then people started saying, you know, there needs to be a book about boys. And I started thinking about it. And I thought, you know, there really, really does. And somebody else should write it. And then I thought, no, there really, really does. And I should write it. And so I kind of had, like, my lizard brain had set me up for it a year ago. So now I'm looking for, I am looking for communities in which I can do interviews with boys. So if there's listeners out there who have ideas for that, they can contact me through my website, which is peggyornstein.com.
And we have a link at yourcallradio.org. I think it's such a good time for this because just yesterday I read an article by Jody Allard. She's a writer in the Washington Post. It's called My Teen Boys Are Blind to Rape Culture. And she's been talking to them about Brock Turner, the swimmer at Stanford. Mm-hmm. And her boys basically said, oh, Mom, you're not talking about rape culture again. They're just denying that this even exists.
Yeah.
And it was such an honest story that she wrote.
Yeah.
She's trying to get through to her boys, and she can't seem to do it.
That has totally gone viral. Yeah, many people have sent me that. And it's interesting. I mean, I think that we, as little as we talk to girls, and I really make the point in Girls and Sex that we don't talk to girls very well or very much, I think we talk to boys less. You know, whether we're parents, whether we're doctors, whether we're teachers, we talk less to boys about their sense. And not only, you know, ideas about rape and rape culture and aggression and coercion, but their own ability to say not only yes, but no. You know, can boys say no ever? You know, what does it mean to be male? What does it mean to be masculine? What is the culture they're exposed to? How is that shaping their experience? What are their questions? What are their confusions? I mean, I think there's really rich territory that I'm very excited about exploring. And you know, it'll be interesting.
Well, and especially at this time when we have access to so much, things that I didn't have access to as a child, and yet we're spending less time actually talking to each other.
Right.
Less time talking to our parents about these important issues.
Right.
Because we're online so much.
Well, yeah, although I don't know that people ever talk to their sons beyond don't get a girl pregnant or, you know, maybe don't give her a disease, don't get a disease. And now I think they're starting to say, and don't rape anybody. But yeah, I think that boys really are underserved. We have a lot of organizations that are geared towards increasing girls' media literacy and helping them understand objectification. But nobody's really talking to boys about those issues, and they're exposed to the same culture that girls are.
Hmm. And the pressures.
And the pressures that they're under, yeah.
Today, I'm speaking with Peggy Ornstein, a best-selling journalist and author, about her new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Peggy decided to write this book after writing another one about young girls, little girls, really, about the princess industrial complex. And she was convinced that its innocent pink and pretty culture was priming little girls for something more insidious later on. And for Peggy, that later is now. She's got a 13-year-old daughter. And she wanted to ask these questions, really important questions. Do today's young women have more freedom than their mothers to shape their sexual encounters? Do they have more influence and more control? She interviewed 70 high school and college age girls about sex, internet porn, hookup culture, and sexual assault on college campuses. This has just exploded in the last couple of years. And she found that so many girls are obsessed with pleasing others rather than being pleased themselves. And so we're talking about how we can really change that dynamic in our society. And we'd love to hear from you. If you are a parent, how do you talk to your kids about sex? What are the differences between the ways you talk to your daughters or in the ways you talk to your sons? If you have any advice for other parents, we'd love to hear from you. If you work in schools, how does your school tackle these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can leave a comment on our website or tweet us at Your Call Radio. So tell us a few stories about what it's been like to visit high schools and colleges. Since are you doing this sort of as, are you talking to a group of students and they're asking questions? Is this kind of a group thing? Or?
Well, we do it different ways. And what I like to do actually is have a student sort of do an onstage interview, because then I can talk about what they want to talk about. Mm. So that's been really fun. And it's these issues. I mean, one of the things, a lot of it is the work from the book, like talking about oral sex. You know, is oral sex sex? Is oral sex not sex? Why has the rates of girls giving versus girls, girls giving oral sex to boys gone up and receiving gone down? And one of the things, my favorite, I think that perhaps my biggest cultural influence is my patented glass of water metaphor, where I talk to young women or to parents and say, what I like to ask girls is, if every time you were with a guy and he asked you to get a glass of water from the kitchen for him, but he never got you a glass of water, or if he did, it was like, do you want me to, like really begrudging, you would not stand for it. These girls would never stand for that. And then they would laugh and they'd say, well, when you put it that way, And I said, well, why don't you put it that way? Why don't you think about it that way? And that generally leads to a discussion about their own discomfort with their bodies and with their genitals. Mm. And the ideas about feeling that, it's both sacred and icky down there. And what we do and don't tell girls about... Well, basically, we don't, right? I mean, one of the things that I talk about in Girls and Sex is that I feel like we do the equivalent with American girls of performing what I call a psychological clitoridectomy on them. And from when they're born, we tend to name all baby boys, at least we say there's their pee-pee, something, but with girls, we leave that part between navel and knees completely mm-hmm. unnamed. Which is the best way to make something unspeakable, right? To not name it. And then they go into their puberty ed classes. And in, we were talking about what kids learn in school. Well, what they learn is that boys have erections and ejaculations, and girls get periods and have unwanted pregnancy, and that's what they learn. And they see that kind of internal diagram that looks like a steer head of girls' anatomy, and then it grays out between the legs, so we never say vulva, we never say clitoris. No surprise, fewer than half of teenage girls 14 to 17 have ever masturbated. And then they go into partnered encounters, and we think that somehow they're going to be able to advocate for themselves, that they're going to be able to think sex is about them, that they're going to be able to, express their needs and wants and limits. And what I in the book, there's a psychologist, Sarah McLachlan at not the folk singer, at University of Michigan, who puts it in terms of intimate justice, and that's this notion that just like who vacuums the rug in your house or who does the dishes, is political as well as personal. Sex brings up those same issues of equality, of economic disparity, of mental health, and we have to ask, who is entitled to engage? Who is entitled to enjoy? Who benefits? How does each partner define good enough? And I think that those issues, and this is another issue of talking to our kids, I think that those issues are very tricky for adult women and sometimes traumatic. Mm. But when I think about girls and their early experiences, I just kept coming back to this idea that I didn't want those to be something that they had to get over.
When you bring up these issues in these high schools specifically, what response do you get from the teachers and the administrators? Do they talk about wanting to bring this into the classroom to further the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. So right. It depends on the school. I mean, they've obviously brought me there. But especially in public schools, you know, there's a lot of community foment and fear. It's like as if we don't tell kids about sex, they won't find out about it, you know, or if we don't tell girls it's supposed to feel good, they won't find out. And they don't very easily, but the results are not what people think. You know, instead, they engage and they don't think it's about them. Whereas what all the research shows is that when girls feel an embodied sense of their sexuality, when they feel that they want their experience to be positive for them, when they understand their body, when they know what pleasure is, then they won't settle for something less than that. Mm-hmm. And it does become a more equitable situation. It does become more ethical, and they engage more responsibly when they do engage. They make real choices.
So, I keep asking this question, but especially for kids who cannot or don't talk about these issues with their parents, and there are many.
Yes.
How can we bring that aspect
into the school? I wish I had a better answer for you. I mean, I keep evading it because I don't have a great answer. I wish that we could have that in the school. I mean, we are going to be talking more about consent now because we have to in California schools, but not what happens after yes, which is so important. And it's a very, you know, in our country, sex education is a wedge issue. It's a political issue. And what I would say to parents who believe that this is necessary is that we have allowed that ground to be ceded to CEDED, the louder voices of people who want to suppress and repress the conversation. And that we have to, as people who know that that has been proven wrong, I mean, abstinence-only education, you know, has been a colossal failure. We have to stand up and say no, and we have to be the loud ones and get our political voice out there in the school boards and in the schools to try to serve our kids better. And that, I think, is the best answer I can give you.
Well, and I feel like when it comes to porn on the left, a lot of people don't want to touch it because they don't want to go down that censorship road.
Right.
And, I mean, I have seen a lot of websites that I agree with, and they're very conservative on porn.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people on the left don't want to go there.
Right, right. And it's a tough one. I mean, if you do go there, you take a lot of flack. And immediately people talk about censorship. But I am certainly talking about teenagers. And we are in a whole new world where explicit media is concerned for teenagers. And kids are seeing things that anything they can imagine and things that they really don't want to imagine and nobody really wants to imagine with the click of a mouse before they've even had their first kiss. They're seeing them at 12. They're seeing them at 13. I mean, some studies will say they're seeing it at 7, maybe, but they're certainly seeing it by 14. And they need to understand minimally that this is not real. I'm not sure why they can. Like, when I've talked to my child about it, I've said, I said it's about as real as pro wrestling, but she doesn't know what pro wrestling is. So, I say, like, look, you know how when we see violence in films, you know that when people get, like, all shot up in those superhero films or whatever it is, that that's not real, right? That's not really how people respond. That's not really what happens. This is the same thing. I'm not sure why that filter of skepticism falls for kids when they see explicit sexual media. So they do need to understand what they will inevitably be exposed to, whether we like it or not.
And this sort of easy access to porn and all this airbrushing and all of that, it has real consequences, because you write that self-objectification has been associated with depression, reduced cognitive function, lower GPA, distorted body image, eating disorders, risky sexual behavior. The list goes on and on.
Yeah, and that's not just explicit media. I mean, that's a result of that's a result of the sort of trickle-down of explicit media into regular media, because you don't really have to watch porn to feel its impact. Now, you can watch a Carl's Jr. ad, it's everywhere. And so girls are bombarded, and this was part of the Princess book, too. Girls are bombarded from an ever younger ages with images that tell them that how they look is more important than who they are, and they wrestle with that. And then they get to be teenagers, and they think, okay, well, so this is what I'm supposed to be like. And then they get called slut, or then they get, dress coded at school. So they're constantly wrestling with this complication of being told that they're going to be rewarded for being increasingly explicit, and also being told, and also learning or being affected, having the negative impacts of that situation, not just being slut-shamed, but these issues of cognitive resources and depression and body monitoring, and in a real bait and switch, girls who self-objectify more have less satisfying sex lives. So who cares, you know, how confident supposedly you are with your body if that confidence comes off with your clothes?
Mm. And this also goes to the culture and how we change the culture, because we recently did a show about sexual, not only sexual assault, but you know, it's happening at Fox News, for example, UC right. Berkeley.
There's so much sexual harassment.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So much is happening right now. And at the end of the show, we want to do another one because we didn't get to spend enough time on this, but why this is still happening and why we need a massive cultural shift.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, that's a huge issue. But when you think about that after reading this book, how do you tackle that issue? After writing this book, how do you tackle that issue?
It is a very, very complicated knot, and I am tackling it a lot, you know, talking about things like dress codes. That's a big issue for middle schools, including the middle school my daughter goes to, and trying to walk this line between, on one hand, not shaming or sexualizing girls by, you know, by saying, because there's a lot of discussion about, you know, which bodies get called out and which bodies don't get called out. So then administrators and teachers are basically deciding who's sexual and who's not. And that's tricky. But also not wanting to push girls into seeing self-objectification as a feminist act, and how to educate them and make sure that they have the resources to be educated as to the impact of self-objectification, and what that means. And even, you know, talking to the young woman that I interviewed in the book, there was a girl, kind of typical thing where she showed me a picture of herself going to a party, and she was wearing, you know, a crop top and a tiny skirt and high heels. And she said, I'm proud of my body, and I never feel more liberated than when I wear skimpy clothing. And I was kind of confounded by that. You know, like, how do I talk about that? And a few minutes later, she said that she wouldn't have worn that same outfit a year earlier because she was 25 pounds heavier. And she was afraid that if she went to a party and wearing that outfit, some boy would call her, you know, the fat girl. And leaving aside the issue of why fat is demonized, but the, mm-hmm. you know, and so then it was like, well, whose body, who gets to be proud of which body under what circumstances, and who decides? So that agency that they think they're claiming is still sort of being dictated by this overarching, you know, boys or male gaze or whatever you want to call it. That means that humiliation lurks just around the corner. So how liberating really is that?
Today I'm speaking with Peggy Ornstein about her latest book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Since she wrote this book, she has been invited to speak at high schools and colleges. Her next book will be focusing on boys and sex. And if you have any questions or comments for Peggy, if you have any thoughts about these really important issues, if you have kids, we'd love to hear from you. Any personal stories about this? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Again, Peggy, you interviewed 70 girls between the ages of 15 to 20 about sex, their experiences, navigating sexual encounters. They were not all straight girls.
No.
You did interview some lesbians.
Yes.
And those findings were pretty interesting.
Yeah, really interesting.
Yeah.
Because there's a tendency for girls more than boys to measure their satisfaction by the yardstick of their partner's pleasure. So girls are more likely to say in a straight relationship, if he's satisfied, I'm satisfied. Whereas boys are more likely, not exclusively by any means, but more likely to say, you know, if I'm satisfied, I'm satisfied. But that investment in partner's pleasure remains true when girls have same-sex encounters. And so the orgasm gap in that you see in straight encounters disappears in same-sex encounters. And what girls would say to me was that they felt free. And so it was they used the same phrase always. They felt free to get off the script and liberated to create an encounter that worked for them. And that was something that was really profound and something we can learn from. And the other thing that gay girls really brought up that was important, gay and well, particularly lesbian girls, was the idea of virginity as defined by first intercourse, that we cling to this notion that there is this one thing that is one thing that girls, you know, isn't really comfortable for girls anyway, usually, that defines you as a sexual adult. And I would, and it's really worth asking, like, how is that really serving girls by making everything else not sex? And, you know, and I think it's not. I think that opens the door to a lot of disrespect and risk. And so I asked one of the lesbian girls that I talked to, how did you know when you weren't a virgin? And she said, yeah, you know, I had to Google that. Google wasn't really sure either. So I said, well, what did you decide? And she said, you know, what I decided was I wasn't a virgin anymore the first time I had an orgasm with a partner. And I thought, wow, what if that was how we defined it, you know? And it was this, it just is this idea that instead of a race to a goal, that sex should be this pool of experiences that includes warmth and affection and communication and sensuality and pleasure and, you know, and who is really the more sexually experienced person? The person who has spent 3 hours making out with a partner they know very well and experimented with erotic tension and sensuality, or the person who gets drunk at a party, hooks up with a random in order to get rid of their virginity before they go to college?
Right.
You know the answer.
We're speaking with Peggy Ornstein, author of Girls and Sex. What about body image? What other differences did you find between the gay girls and the straight girls?
You know, I remember being in a group interview that I was doing, and the girls, there was a lot of conversation among the girls about negotiating clothing. And thinking about, you know, what they were going to wear, what it was going to evoke, whether they were going to be called sluts, whether they were going to be harassed. And then one of the girls piped up and said, you know, sometimes I don't know what you girls are talking about. She said, you know, I'm gay and I just wear what's comfortable. I don't know. So that was sort of interesting, because what girls will say a lot of times is, you know, that things are a personal choice. That was particularly one of the big issues was the removal of pubic hair, which is, you know, something that is a real generational divide. And what they would often say is, it's a personal choice and I do it for myself. And I would say, you mean, so if you were on a desert island with nothing but a razor, you would keep doing that? Because it wouldn't maybe be my first choice. And then, you know, at the same time, these are girls who have never masturbated, never had an orgasm. So the only thing that they're doing for themselves is removing their pubic hair, which just seemed, you know, a shame to me, I guess. You know, it just seemed like difficult to think about, and became a real kind of crusade. I spent a lot of time writing about and talking about pubic hair, I have to say, which is not really what I expected to do with my life, but it seems to be doing a public service, so it's okay.
Well, let's take a few calls before we end. Let's hear from Angela in San Francisco. Hi, Angela. Welcome to the show. Hello, Angela.
Oh.
Hi, Angela?
No.
Oh, is this Nancy?
No, this is Sarah.
Oh, hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Oh, let us keep guessing.
Oh, I'm on air. Okay. So I just had a question. I have young kids. They're 5 and 7 years old, or just about to turn 7. And I'm wondering how you talk to kids that age about pleasure, because the books that I've got to talk to them about, you know, sex and reproduction, they're all more or less technical, and there's not very much about enjoyment. And I'm just wondering, for kids that age, you know, how do you start that conversation so that they start with a good
Do you have the Robie Harris books, like It's Not the Stork? And
yeah, they're the ones I've used.
But they do a little bit.
A lot about, like, love. And, you know, I mean, that's not always going to be the exact setting.
Right.
You know what I mean? It seems to frame it a certain way.
Right. So I would recommend two other books for you, for adults, which is a Diapers to Dating is a really great book that talks about sort of developmentally appropriate ways to talk about different issues along the line, and also Talk to Me First by Deborah Rothman. Those are sort of my go-to books for parents. Diapers to Dating is particularly good for younger kids up to about 12 years old. And I think making them aware of, you know, well, a lot of at that age they're getting a little old for this, but even younger kids, anybody who's a preschooler knows that, you know, they masturbate a lot, and that's great. And, you know, just helping them understand, like, you know, that in our culture, that's something that we do privately and not at grandma's Thanksgiving table. You know, that feels really good. It feels really good to touch your vulva, and that's great, but we do that privately and not at grandma's Thanksgiving table, is one way to start that conversation of not demonizing pleasure, pointing out that things feel good. As they get older, understanding, you know, that hugging or caressing once, you know, feels good, and also understanding boundaries. You know, if somebody doesn't like to hug, you don't hug. Or if, you know, now there's a lot of discussion, which I think is great, about do you make your child hug, you know, Great Aunt Nancy? Or do you say she doesn't want to, and that's her choice, and that's her boundary? So I think that is something. But I think that those two books, Diapers to Dating and Talk to Me First, are really will give you some great resources on that. Also, another really great resource is the Unitarian Universalist Church. They do the best sex ed curriculum called Our Whole Lives, OWL.
Wow.
It starts at 5, and it goes all the way into the senior citizen years, and it's worth joining the church for. It's fantastic.
Wow, I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
We should maybe bring them on.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for calling. Let's go to Angela in San Francisco.
That Angela, she just doesn't want to be on the show. No.
Hi, Angela. Sorry, we're having some phone issues.
Right.
Hi, is anyone there? Hi, you're on the air.
This is Janelle.
Hi, Janelle.
Hi. So this is so interesting because I called with a question about my 3-year-old fraternal boy-girl twin, but I'm a lesbian, and the last turn the conversation took was amazing. So let's start with the kids because they're the priority now.
All right.
A boy and a girl, I love them both. They're great kids. But eventually, they're going to need their own rooms. I just want to know what your thought is about what age or developmental point that is. And the other question is, if we sit them both down to have the sex talk together, it's going to have to look at both of them and say, here is the stark difference between male and female.
You know what? I don't know. I don't have the answer about the room, honestly. I think that's something you should ask your pediatrician. But these days, the education is done together. They don't separate boys and girls. And one of the things that they do, I sat in on a class, puberty ed class, for fourth and fifth graders, and they talk about what is similar before they talk about what is different. You know, at puberty, a lot of things that happen for boys and girls are the same. You know, everybody grows hair. Everybody gets pimples. Everybody gets kind of stinky. Everybody, you know, their genitals change. Everybody gets taller. So there's a lot that you can talk about that emphasizes similarity, as well as talk. Everybody, you know, becomes capable of reproducing. So you can sort of start with what is alike about them. And then talk about some of the smaller things that are important, but different. The difference isn't necessarily as big as you might think. Another person besides Karis, who's really great in this area with this as a classroom resource, is a woman named Jennifer Devine, and she is actually a Unitarian minister, but one with pink hair and you know, Bay Area style, and. I've sat in on her classes, and she really does a great job of both helping kids understand what's alike and helping kids understand what's different and labeling all the body parts. I mentioned in the book that I was sitting in on one of her classes, and the kids were doing sort of they had done their unit on the female body, and they were supposed to label all the parts of the external genitalia. And there were these two boys I was sitting behind, fifth graders, and one of them said to the other, "Hey, you know, what's this again?" And the other one said, "That's the clitoris. It's for making good feelings." And that's all you got to say at that age, you know, to them. That's the clitoris. It's for making good feelings. But I thought, I want my, you know, I would want my kid dating that boy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, so that's it. I think that you start by talking about what's the same for everybody. Consent is the same for everybody.
Mm.
Reciprocity, ethics, there's a lot that's the same for everybody.
Well, over the holiday break, we'd love to have you back, and we can bring in some students.
Oh, that'd be
when they're
fun.
Out of school. I would love to do that.
That would be super fun.
Peggy Ornstein is author of Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Peggy, thanks again for coming in.
My pleasure, always.
Thank you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.